You are listening to WCJV Digital Broadcasting, Youngstown, New York.
The Paranormal News Insider from ParanewsInsider.com. Produced by WCJV Digital Broadcasting, Youngstown, New York.
Welcome to the Paranormal News Insider for the week of November 14th, 2017, and episode number 337. And this is your host, Dr. Brian D. Parsons. Yes, I took a week off, kind of unplanned, but we'll talk about that here in a second. Tonight, this week's news includes the Loch Ness Monster, getting a lot of press lately. It's the top mystery in the UK, and we'll talk about that latest sighting, the eighth sighting of this year of the Loch Ness Monster. Also, we're going to talk MUFON sighting statistics for October. I love numbers. And it was bound to happen again. And we'll also have the book of the week, a little bit of an update here on conferences and conventions. And who knows what else will happen tonight on the Paranormal News Insider. This week's episode is brought to you by Thomas Francis University. Thomas Francis University is a metaphysics school that offers online spiritually based bachelor's, master's, and PhD doctoral metaphysical degrees, as well as single standalone courses in related metaphysical and esoteric topics. Instructors are easily accessible and offer world-class customer service and instruction. TFU and other ICMH schools have hundreds of students and graduates in more than 50 countries worldwide. For more information on Thomas Francis University, please visit tfuniversity.org. All right, bills are paid. Hopefully the power stays on for a little while. Anyway, I missed last week's show. I had no power, and so therefore I couldn't see the studio, so I had no way to broadcast the show, and life is scary when you have no internet. Yeah. When your Wi-Fi is out, it's just you don't know what to do. You can't survive. I mean, electricity, that's no big deal. Water, no big deal. Food, I don't know. As long as there's a stray donut here and there. But no Wi-Fi, that's catastrophic. I know I'm making fun of it. But it's kind of weird when you have no power and you walk into the bathroom and you try to flick the light switch. It takes a good day and a half to get rid of that that reaction to do that. It's funny, and I always think about that every time I lose power. But anyway, stemming back, let's go all the way back to November 3rd. Wow, it's been a while, guys. November 3rd, I had to work. I got up at 4 o'clock in the morning, worked all day, came home, and then was going to head out to the Bedford, Pennsylvania, for the excavation for Victorian ghosts at the Bedford Springs Resort. And one of my fellow speakers at the event, Brandon Masullo, lives here in Ohio. And, well, we decided to carpool. It's a smart thing to do. So we took off here a little later than I think we both wanted to go, and hopefully to avoid the deer. And got into town a little too late. We were a little too tired to really go and do anything. Weren't able to get a hold of anybody because they were already in progress in wrapping. I think at the time they were wrapping up the ghost tour and getting ready to do the ghost excavation, which is a really interesting process. I know I've talked about it here a few times on the show, and it essentially is not. It's similar to a reenactment, where you're wearing period clothing and using period verbiage, but you're not reenacting, because the reenactment is for basically entertainment purposes, but this is using all these things, the dress and the terminology and different things, but geared towards specific things that would have happened at specific times with specific people. So it's almost as if you're going back in time and trying to relive something that might have happened or did happen, and kind of be using a little bit of an artistic license with that to hopefully spur or get the attention of either a haunting or some sort of intelligent apparition, so you can interact and connect with the past. So it's essentially how John Sable kind of says this is, it's not 21st century investigators kind of have a horizontal look at things. They have their tools and technology, and they're asking questions, and they're representing themselves as 21st century investigators. Whereas a ghost excavation, it digs down, it goes deep into the strata, and it's attempting to resonate with past history. Hopefully that explains that pretty well. And it's unfortunate, because last year I also missed the ghost excavation because, well, I decided to go deer hunting with my car after the ghost tour. And so in between the ghost tour and the ghost excavation, I was dealing with the local, there were the Bedford Police Department, and getting my car towed and having to call, you know, all those phone numbers you have to call. And it was a lot of fun, not really. So, yeah, this year was a little disappointing, too, being a little too tired. I don't know how long I would have made it anyway. But the Bedford Springs Resort and Spa, that's a beautiful building. And it's very historical, very old. And it's very similar to the way it was back in those times. It has an old pool, indoor pool, and the staircases and everything. I mean, the inside is modernized, but you just get that feeling of the past history just walking around. And it's really a beautiful place to go. A little expensive, not going to lie. I couldn't afford to stay there. I had to stay at the Super 8 and had the money to stay there at the Omni Bedford Springs Resort and Spa. So, yeah, we just kind of went to the hotel and slept and got up the next morning for the speakers, which started at 10 o'clock with Mary Becker. She kicked off the event this year, and followed by John Sable talking about excavating Victorians, digging into the past, layering the future. And John is always a really good speaker, the way he comes across, the way he gets his ideas and uses a lot of references to drive home his ideas and thoughts. Very inspiring person to listen to and to learn from as well, with his ghost excavation methodology. And after him was Rosemary Ellen Guiley. And she talked a lot about mirrors, black mirrors in particular, and scrying, which is I actually bought a book. I really never really got into that all that much over the years, just a little bit, but always wanted to get a book on that, just kind of read up on it. So eventually I'll talk about that book here on the show. I tell you what, Rosemary, she's got 65 books, something like that. Just an immense amount of knowledge and experience with her. And she was there pretty much well through that. And then later on in the evening, we had some other activities, which I'll talk about here in a second. And you can find out more about Rosemary Ellen Guiley at visionaryliving.com. And after Rosemary's, her mirrors, portals into the afterlife and spirit realm, we had Rick Fisher. Rick Fisher is an aficionado of Ouija boards. And I was excited because when you walked into the room, the conference room at the Omni Bedford Springs Resort and Spa, I feel like they owe me money for all this. When you walked into the room, there was all these Ouija boards on the front of the room. And I was like, wow, this is awesome. Like, you go any other convention, people would probably run for the door screaming and probably throwing salt over their shoulder or something weird. I don't know. Spilling water, holy water. I don't know. Spring water. I don't know. It's something. But it was cool. And one of the Ouija boards was one of the original designs of the Ouija board. It went back to, 1891. He had some others that were from the early 1900s and the mid-1900s. So it was really cool to see all that historical things, and they don't bother me. They don't scare me. It's just wood and plastic to me. It's the user. It's the person behind it. And Rick Fisher talked a lot about the Ouija boards, Tales from the Talking Boards, and I agreed with pretty much everything he said. I mean, he nailed it with how they were used by religious organizations really to scare people away from spiritualism and get them back as parishioners. I mean, it's pretty much the truth here. And 1891. I was looking through my notes here. So Rick really told it how it is and talked about a lot of cases, however, that were tied into Ouija boards and potential issues that might have actually happened because of the boards or maybe because of the fear of them. So it was kind of well balanced. It wasn't all against Ouija boards and everything. After that, probably one of my, I don't want to say my favorite speaker, because that's not fair. Everybody was really good. And this isn't like your typical convention where it's all about, hey, look at my orbs. That doesn't sound right. Look at my orb pictures. I guess maybe that's a better way to put it. And, personal investigations from ghost investigators. These are a lot of people with different ideas. And we're looking at different things tied into the Victorian era. So everybody kind of touched on the Victorian era a little bit maybe little ways or big ways. And this next speaker, Margaret Bile, I was really excited to meet her because she has in her possession one of the tables that was used in the 10-year Philip experiment that started in 1972 in Canada. Well, Toronto, that's in Canada. So I'm a huge fan of the Philip experiment, not just the Philip experiment, but where the work came from with the Philip experiment. It's actually bits and pieces of that have made up my personal E4 method. So I've read a lot about this in journals, psychical research journals, and a lot of books. I've gotten my hands on as almost as much as I really wanted to, except for the Philip experiment book, the one that I really, really want, but I can't find it. It's expensive. But anyway, she had the table there and it was signed by the 8 original people that took part in this. Like I said, 10 years they did this, and she talked about the process and what they did and how their approaches changed and different things. And it was really exciting to hear about this because, again, I've studied this for years, and part of it made up my E4 method, which is my client-based paranormal methodology that I created back in 2012. And to actually to touch this table and to see it, as well as have it in the room later on that night when we did a table tipping session, it made me giddy. It was really fun to actually take part in that. It was really, really cool. Even though, yeah, it's the spiritual, the spiritualism era stuff. Nobody does table tipping stuff anymore. Nobody does that stuff. But to me, it's fun. It's interesting, and it's a way to connect with history and the way things were done. But just to see that table where the Philip experiment took place, just awesome, just really cool. And it's the table. If you ever look at pictures, some of the later pictures, there is a bluish table, bluish table top table. It's a real small, it's like a card table, basically. Nothing major, nothing big, just real basic, simple stuff. That's the table, the blue, bluish card table on top. Let's see. Then we had Robert Brad Bradley. He talked about paranormal investigation equipment then and now, which was a little mad about that because that's what I wanted to talk about. But we probably could have both done it because he did something a little bit different than what I would have done. But he did tackle all the issues with modern tools, and he did a fantastic job at that. And he's kind of a scientist kind of guy. His work, his job is kind of science-based, so he has that mentality in his investigations and his overall approach in working in the field. So he and I see eye to eye on a lot of stuff, and I really respect his work, and I think he's a fantastic investigator. And if you want to learn more about Robert Brad Bradley, you can find more information about his team at virginiaghosts.com, and also some of the stuff that he's working on. I can't remember his ghost team's name off the top of my head, but Virginia, forget. I'm not even going to try. But anyway, great guy, great presentation about paranormal investigation equipment throughout the ages. And then we had Alex Matsuo, who talked spiritualism, rise of modern media culture. Trying to read my own notes. Jeez. Well, she covered a couple of I don't remember if I talked about this story. Well, I think I did. Athena Doris, is that the story I talked about here on the Halloween show? It was one of the earliest ghost stories ever told. She talked about that. I was really excited because nobody ever really talks about that. And she talked about a lot of other interesting things happening there in the Victorian era, especially with spiritualism, which is, again, another thing that that I've studied over the years, because it's about belief. It's about buy-in into the paranormal. And it's really, you know, a lot of people think that the paranormal just started in 2004 when the Ghost Hunters came on. And then nobody was into this field at all until that show came on. No, that's not true. I mean, there were literally thousands of people that were involved in belief in ghosts, ghost research, or wanting to connect somehow, some way. And spiritualism, I mean, it's a religion that's still going on today. So thoroughly enjoyed her presentation. Probably, you know, one of the top ones as well. And she actually has the book of the week this week. And she, I'll talk more about her background, all her stuff later on when I talk about her book. She runs a group called the Association of Paranormal Study. And you could find that at, of all places, associationofparanormalstudy.com. You can also find out more information about her at alexmatsuo.com. That's alexmatsuo.com, Alex Matsuo. And we're going to jump ahead to Brandon Masulo, who, yeah, I hitched a ride. Well, no, he hitched a ride with me. That's right. Well, he took me home last year after my deer hunting incident. So I guess it was nice of me to return the favor and drive us out there. And he talked about new theories on Victorian era ghostly encounters. And obviously, this is really all based on his latest book, The Ghost Files, which was the book of the week a few weeks ago, which is a fairly new release. And he's doing very well with that book. And if you haven't gotten that book, my goodness, you're really missing out. Excellent work in this book. Kind of taking ghosts in a little bit different of a direction. And I dig it. I really, it's weird because it kind of correlates with a lot of my thoughts and ideas towards ghosts as well. So it's weird that I see eye to eye with somebody who's has a little bit different of a background than I do. And again, I totally agree with where he's going with this. And if you are like many other people, that if you're in the ghost field, that a lot of people like to sit around and speculate about what they think ghosts are. This is definitely a book that you want to read. It will change the way you think about ghosts. I'll never forget that line. It's a very powerful line in that book. And it's true. It kind of, even for me, that I think a little bit outside the paranormal box, it kind of, it did, I'm going to admit it, it influenced me a little bit and got me thinking in different directions about ghosts. And it's, again, it's an awesome book, The Ghost Studies. And if you want to find out more about Brandon and his books and all his other stuff, he's got a website, hauntedtheories.com. And you can also catch Brandon next year, February 17th, at the Twinsburg Paranormal Conference in Twinsburg, Ohio, Northeast Ohio, smack dab between Cleveland and Akron. Don't miss it. And let's see. Well, I was the next speaker after Brandon, and I don't know. It was okay. I kind of used Sherlock Holmes a little bit. And I talked about a story that happened in, I remember the year, drawing a blank here. But it was in the Victorian era, and it was essentially about a crisis apparition. And I'm sorry, 1875 was the year. I had to look at my notes. And it was about a crisis apparition that happened. And this gentleman documented this about 9 years after it actually happened. And so he talked to a couple of psychical researchers and documented all the story of the entire story of this person coming into his room. And he saw this person at a conversation. And then supposedly this person died, and all this information was conveyed. And it wasn't too long after this that somebody had written a letter and said, hey, wait, a lot of these facts are incorrect. And this person provided all this information that proved that a lot of this information that this person provided, not right, not correct. So kind of a segue into talking about the illusion of memory and how our memory can fool us over time. And during that, I kind of talked about the tools and technology a little bit, just to kind of talk about some of the things that we don't really consider when doing paranormal investigations, client-based paranormal investigations, or at least listening to stories on paranormal investigations. And closing out the show was Herman Mike Stevenson. He was talking about the connection between EVPs, EMIs, and EOCs, and the science behind them. That's a lot of acronyms there, but essentially they're all kind of similar to EVPs, electronic voice phenomena, all these other things. But he basically talked about how he's researching and investigating the sound of EVPs and looking at them very, very deeply and looking for correlations and looking to find out where these sounds are actually coming from. Very in depth into the ranges and the science behind the sounds, I guess, and that's his focus. Then after that, we had a little break for dinner. We went to I can't remember the name of that place. Really old place. We didn't have a very good experience at this place, and so probably better I don't even mention them. Then we had a little bit of wind down time, maybe 20 minutes. And then Brandon and I headed back to the Omni Bedford Springs Resort and Spa, where we kind of walked in. They were doing a table tipping session led by Margaret Bile. And the table was rocking, but we still came a knocking. And yeah, the table was dancing pretty well, and it was moving all over the room. And yeah, so it took us a few minutes to get in there. We finally got in there and we saw Mike Stevenson with his camera up over the table. He was filming everything. And there was six people around the table. The table is moving really, really good. And after about, 5-10 minutes of observing from a distance, I got to partake and was on the table. And I've done this before. I've done table tipping sessions before, and when your table is moving, Mr. Negative here, but when the table is moving, generally when it's rocking gently, that's pretty much what they call the ideomotor effect, or unconscious muscular action. It's when your hands or your fingers are just lightly on the table, you have multiple people, you have a heartbeat. So your hands move whether you realize it or not, no matter how hard you try to steady them. This is exemplified if you hold something out at a distance. You can see how it's moving. Like if you've ever tried to shoot a bow and arrow, you can see how hard it is. You have to time it with your breath and everything. So our bodies have these little movements. And when you get six people around a table, especially people that are across from each other, these things are going to, if they line up just right, they're going to counteract. And the table will move pretty well on its own. But there's also the reaction to that table moving. And sometimes we unconsciously will kind of push back. We don't mean to do it. It's not intentional. So a lot of the table moving around was not intentional. But it's when you get, and it's actually, not to sound like to blow the, it's actually necessary for the person that's involved in the table tipping session to buy in that this movement is caused by a ghost, because that's when the real magic happens. Although it is caused by people initially, when that table starts to dance and the people just relax and have fun, this is a recipe that actually starts to bring in, if there is something in that area, that's when you're allowing these things to continue and allowing the things to move on. And as much as I hate to admit it, and I'm one of these anti ghost investigating in the dark people, I think it's really silly and stupid, but it does set the mood. It does set the investigator into that proper mental mode of allowing the paranormal to take over, to take effect and to move in. And when you become too skeptical and too observant and too critical of what's going on, then that's when things get chased away. So you just, you know, it might be hard for me, I guess, to just kind of ignore all that. But, you know, I did my best just to live in the moment and have fun with it. And it was exciting. It was neat to take part in it. You know, you don't really take it seriously, but it was neat. And then we held a seance as well. And Margaret and I guess we all kind of partook. Is that a word? Partook. But Rosemary Ellen Guiley and Margaret Bile both kind of led that for the most part. And we were using a black mirror essentially to focus on in the middle of the room. And there was a lot of interesting things that happened. But I don't know. The table tipping thing was far cooler to me than a seance. I've done seances as well. Have used seances in the past really in haunted locations to try to connect to things. Sometimes it puts you to sleep. And hopefully I'm not doing that to you right now. But so we got out of there about 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning. Pretty tired. Went back to the hotel. Crashed. Not literally. Figuratively. And got up the next morning. Had a little breakfast. Headed back in. We wanted to get back in early. I had to work on my show. And it was supposed to have a radio show on Monday night. Supposed to have an appearance on a show. So I knew I only had really Sunday to get my show prepared for November 7th. And, well, there was really heavy rain we drove through on the way home. It was pretty windy, pretty rainy. cars were slowing down. It was a little scary, but I'm used to driving through all that stuff, so no real big deal. Get home and it was nice out. Not really sunny, but clear. And, you know, it had rained a little bit. No big deal. Working on my show, then all of a sudden it starts to storm and it gets really bad. And I'm a weirdo because when it storms, I like to go outside. Or at least I like to, you know, kind of partially be outside, just kind of observe the weather. I know I'm weird. That's dangerous. It's stupid, but that's just how I am. And I was really watching the storm and the lightning and the wind. And well, you can't see wind, but you get to see the effects of wind, as I'm told. And really just kind of watching this, and it, you know, it doesn't really normally make me nervous. I've seen tornadoes. I've been in super heavy thunderstorms where the whole entire sky is green. And I've seen winds, you know, 80, 90 miles an hour. Never really bothered me. But this storm, the wind just got so bad and so violent. And when you're seeing cars rocking, you know something's not right. And the wind just kept getting stronger and stronger. So I told my wife, we need to get away from the windows now. This is bad. This is not normal. This is beyond just a thunderstorm. Something is not right. And just as I said it, you could see flashes of the transformers popping. The power goes out. The power comes back on. The power goes out. And after a couple minutes of that, it finally went out for good around 6:30 p.m. on Sunday night. And it was pretty bad. I had to work the next morning, and roads were blocked. Roads were closed. Power was out everywhere in my entire area. And where I work, our store was out of power. We had a backup generator that had come in during the middle of the night. I work in a very large retail establishment, and we sell groceries, frozen and refrigerated items, and all those items unfortunately, we're ruined. So we had to dispose of all of that, which was quite expensive. And we were one of the very few places that had power. So we're pretty busy with customers, people coming in that didn't have, you know, access to some of people have wells, so they couldn't get water. I wasn't able to take a shower for like 3 days. Thank goodness I'm on the radio. But it was scary times, and we had there was reportedly 9 tornadoes in Northwest Ohio as well as Northwest Pennsylvania. So scary times, scary moments, but the power finally came back on late Tuesday night, just before midnight. And I have a stereo that, for some reason, whenever the power goes out, comes back on, the thing turns itself all the way up. And so I was asleep, and the thing pops on, and I flipped out. I jumped up. I had to turn things off and turn things on. I had to check on the Wi-Fi, because that's the most important thing. You're tuned into WCJV Digital Broadcasting from Youngstown, New York, emanating live at WCJVRadio.com. And you're listening to the Paranormal News Insider with your host, Dr. Brian D. Parsons. And yes, I survived the great power outage of November 2017 here in Northeast Ohio. We had, I was talking to Cindy, my producer here, before we started the show. And on the way home today, now today is Tuesday, the 14th. And well, at least where I'm sitting, I don't know about you listening. But yeah, the storm was Sunday. Was it the 5th? The 5th. And today on the way home, we had still roads that were, well, areas where they're cutting, still cutting down trees that were resting up against power lines. They're still working on power lines. Everyone has power. But it's, man, it's still a massive cleanup in this area. And I'm pretty sure we had, they're saying straight line winds. But I think we had a little bit more than that. No confirmed tornado in my area, but it had to be darn close. It had to be winds in excess of 80, 90 miles an hour. I don't know, microburst, macroburst. I've heard different things, but still pretty bad stuff. Anyway, you came for the news. But I did want to talk about this convention. I think it's important that if I take part in these things, that I do discuss them. And it was a very interesting conference, and the people involved in this are all – they're really involved. They're really passionate about what they do and how they do it. It's just interesting to get all these people in the same room. We're all diverse. We're all from different locations, different areas, but we all work against the grain. We all work against the popular way of doing things, and it's great to be in a room with people that they might not agree with what I think, but they don't agree with – what the whole thinks, which is fantastic. And we all learn from each other. And that's really what these kinds of things are all about. That's why I like the conference style, where people are talking about their ideas and their thoughts and opinions about things with their work backing up that all that versus a kind of a convention style where everyone's just showing off their work. But sometimes, you know, entertainment is fun too, but I really, really enjoy the events put on by John Sable and Mary Becker. Now, speaking of conferences, conventions, I'll mention this real quick. I was updating the list for 2017 and got a little carried away the other day and started adding events for 2018, which I don't normally do until really about December when things are really definitively turned on and ready to go. And but I got a little carried away. I got about 18, I think 17 or 18. Ghost events for 2018. I haven't really worked on UFOs or cryptids yet, although there are a few, but I'm getting excited. 2018, right around the corner. So you can check out that little list. It's going to grow. It's going to get bigger. Trust me. And if you have any information about any event, rest assured, I still have a lot of work to do. I know there's a lot out there that I haven't gotten yet, but if there is one that you know definitively is happening in 2018, or maybe I missed one happening on the last month and a half here that's not on the list, you can let me know at insider@paranewsinsider.com or go to paranewsinsider.com and click on the contact link at the top and give me a shout out. I mean, social media, Facebook, Twitter, you name it, I'll respond. It might take me a little while, but I'll respond as long as I have power. And let's talk some stories, right? Let's talk about some news, right? That's what you're here for. Cryptid news, the Loch Ness Monster. I don't know where, it's like this thing disappears for months on end, and then all of a sudden there's all these stories that come out of the woodwork, or I guess come out of the water. Now, the Loch Ness Monster has officially been named Britain's top supernatural phenomena, according to a very informal poll taken right around Halloween by the TV channel Really, that's really what it's called, Really, based in the UK. The results showed that the Loch Ness Monster received 42% of the votes. The number two phenomena was the prehistoric Stonehenge. Wow, Stonehenge got beat out by the Loch Ness Monster. Wow. The Beast of Bodwin Moor in Cornwall, which is an alleged panther-like anomalous big cat. They call them ABCs, anomalous big cat, or alien big cat over there in the UK, that is purported to roam the area since the 1970s. The haunting of a suburban council house in North London, which is known as, you might know this, as the Enfield Poltergeist case, which if you know that, you might also know that it was the focus of the movie The Conjuring 2, was only named fourth. Huh. The strange and ongoing story of the Overton Bridge in West Dumbarshire finished in the top five. This is weird and wacky. I remember reading about this years ago. It's a bridge where 50 dogs have leapt to their death in the past 70 years, and purportedly hundreds more have survived the fall. Weird. It's a weird thing. They think it's kind of an illusion. I don't know why they don't fix it or put a railing there or something. I don't know. Agatha Christie's disappearance for 11 days back in 1926, which was never fully solved. Let's see, the Rendlesham Forest incident in 1980, or purported UFO sightings over UK and US military bases, and the appearance of strange hoof marks, including on top of homes known as the Devil's Footprints. The 1970s purported haunting of a cemetery by a vampire known as the Highgate Vampire, and the ghosts of Hampton Court also made the top 10. But the Loch Ness Monster was number one. And if you want to read that story, I'm going to throw that in the chat room. Hopefully it doesn't land on somebody. Boof. There it is. And, well, that's not it. That's not it. About the Loch Ness Monster. He's back. The first sighting, I'm thinking since October 2nd, I believe. I think it's in my story here. Young Sam Knight, what a cool name, was on a cruise on Loch Ness in November when he took a picture of the elusive Loch Ness Monster. Well, that's what some people are claiming. The 9-year-old Sam was on holiday with his family when he took the photograph. He did not see the creature initially, but his mom saw the shape in the water after reviewing the pictures. The website LochNessSightings.com has put this photograph in the official records as the 8th official sighting of this year, and the first since, like I said, October 2nd of this year. Now, looking back historically, there were only a total of 7 official sightings in 2016, and what you didn't see there was my finger quotes in the air, official sightings. 5 in 2015, 6 in 2014, no sightings in 2013, and only 2 recorded in 2012. And this actually marks the most sightings since the year 2000, where there was a whopping 11 documented sightings registered through the LochNessSightings.com website. Gary Campbell, the keeper of the records, says that a majority of the sightings do not actually make it into the register, especially if they can be explained or are found to be a part of a hoax. So did young Sam Knight really see the Loch Ness Monster? Well, probably not. I mean, obviously, if he didn't see it and had to look at a photograph after the fact, he probably didn't see it. Now, the photograph is a close area. If you've not seen this picture, I don't have it cropped out, but I'll throw the link in the chat room. You can check it out. And also, if you're not listening live or you're not in the chat room, don't fear. I'll put out these stories, the links to these stories during the week after the show, probably starting tomorrow, because tonight you're going to get the show link so you can listen in if you missed it. And I'll put these stories out during the week so you can check out the photographs and the stories as well. Now, the photograph was a close area of the water, and it appears to have some fairly nice-sized waves. If you kind of look kind of close, you can see the waves kind of rolling a little bit. And the purported fin, which is what they're saying, is that this is some sort of fin sticking out of the water, is actually at the top of the wave where a crest would form. Now, to me, this is nothing more than the top of a wave that's beginning to blow over, essentially as a white cap. And fairly normal, but you don't see any other ones in the picture, which is kind of, I think, why people are jumping to this. But this wave that you're seeing is the most fully formed in that way. It's really the only one that we see in that picture that would be completely crested, so that the top would be able to be blown over by the wind and would create a white cap. Now, explained or debated, the story is actually really cool. Besides this being this official eighth thing, because of this kid. Now, Sam, he's 9 years old. He's actually a fan of cryptozoology. And his mom says, quote, he loves mythical creatures and is also obsessed with the Tasmanian tiger. We went to Loch Ness in the half term largely for his benefit. It's a bit cheaper than flying to Australia, unquote. No kidding. It's a lot quicker, too. Sam is actually not a true believer of the Loch Ness Monster, as his mom reports that he feels it's more than likely an eel or a sturgeon. Smart kid. Although it was also reported that Sam brought some ropes, I don't know, he must have a big backpack, in hopes of tying the creature to the boat, as well as a genetic testing kit. Yeah, okay, really smart kid. Well, at least he's too young, I hope, to hoist a harpoon. Not sure if he had one of those in his backpack either, but I guess pretty smart kid. He wanted to snare it right then and there and test it right in the water. Well, I think he's going to make a good cryptozoologist in the future. Pretty cool. So anyway, let me put the – oh, here's the story. I'll put the sun. Don't trust them, but this story you can trust. And if you're also interested, I'll put the official website. Yes, the Loch Ness Monster has an official website, lochnesssightings.com. I'll put that in the chat room as well. Interesting stuff. You can get all the statistics to all the sightings and a little bit of a description, as well as photographs of all of these as well through that website at lochnesssightings.com. UFO news, we'll talk about that real quick. MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, has released the sighting statistics from October of 2017. Obviously, we're in November, so they've wrapped up October, so we can talk about it. And first, I want to talk quickly about the numbers from September. Now, for the month of September, MUFON reported 622 total worldwide sightings, with 430 of those taking place here in the United States. Now, I don't even know if I should mention this, but I'll mention this. I typically take a guess at the numbers for the following month. And the reason I don't want to mention this is in the last few months, my predictions have been, shall I say, a little off? A lot off, some more or less. But anyway. It's still interesting to see how their numbers go, and I try to predict it as to how I think that these numbers are going to flow. So my predictions for October were 571 worldwide sightings, with 364 for the United States. Again, that's my October predictions, and again, I was off a little more than I'd like to, as the numbers from MUFON for October are 659 worldwide sightings, a lot lower than I predicted, or actually a lot higher than I predicted, and 482 here in the United States. So a very big increase. I'm not sure what caused that, but good for MUFON to get that large number. The United States was the top reported country, obviously, because MUFON is based here in the United States, and a majority of its investigators are also based here in the United States, as well as the largest network of people involved, obviously. Canada finished second with 61 sightings, and the United Kingdom had 26, Germany had 19, and then things dropped off dramatically, with India, Argentina, and Australia turning in 7 reports each. Mexico had 6, Brazil turned in 5, France had 4, and the remaining 23 countries turned in 3 or fewer reports, and 15 countries turned in 1 report each. The breakdown of the United States had California in the lead with 67 sightings. Texas was second with 40. Washington State and Florida turned in 24 reports. And Pennsylvania had 22. Ohio and Illinois had 21. And Missouri had 19. Michigan turned in 17. 16 for New York, Arizona, and Indiana. Let's see, Colorado, New Mexico, and North Carolina had 11 each. And it just drops off here. Kentucky with 10, Georgia, Maryland, and Oregon had 9, Oklahoma, Virginia, and Minnesota had 8, and 25 other states, including the District of Columbia, turned in 7 or less reports each. Hawaii and the District of Columbia turned in 1 report each. Pretty rare to see Hawaii in here. But it's cool. There's some interesting things that I noticed when putting these numbers together, which is that's going to show up in the per capita numbers, which is something I do. Now, MUFON used to do this. They used to report the per capita, but they don't do it anymore. I think they just felt that it was pretty insignificant, which it is. But to me, I think it's important because it shows a nice representation of which states are reporting more sightings based on their population. So if you do an average, and I should mention that the I have been using a 2014 numbers, but they have just updated on my list that I use for 2016. So the numbers have kind of changed. Some of the state rankings have actually changed. California is still number one. I didn't do November numbers. Just thought of that. Anyway, well, I'll think of that as we go through this. But per capita, what I do is first I look at the U.S. Total population, and I get a number based on how many sightings were happening here in the United States. So that number is 0.151, 0.151 per capita. Very insignificant. It's 15% of a person, essentially, in the United States reported a UFO last month. But it does set the tone. So it shows you the average of what each state should be. And obviously, some states are going to be higher, some states are going to be lower. And a lot of this also fluctuates with how many sightings a state actually has. Now, California, which is still ranked, like I said, number one in the U.S., they had a whopping 67 sightings, but their per capita is actually a 0.170. So they are above average against the U.S. number. Texas, number two, they had 40 sightings. They were a 0.144, so below average. And we had Florida, number three in population. They had 24 sightings. They had a 0.116, so well below average. And then we see some interesting numbers here. Washington State, they're actually ranked number 13 in the listing of states. They had 24 sightings, which I thought was really very significant. And it turns out that their per capita number is 0.330, which is double of what California is, and a little bit more double than the average. So that's, to me, is significant, especially with 24 sightings. Pennsylvania, which is the sixth largest state in population, had 22 sightings. They turned in a 0.172.
Double of what California
pretty insignificant,
is.
Very just
a little bit more
slightly
double
ahead
average
of California, not much there at all. Ohio had 21 sightings there, ranked number 7 in population, turned in a .181. Not impressive, Ohio. Sorry, Buckeye State. Not very great. New York ranked number 4 in population. They had 16 sightings, 16, which is, again, I thought that was very significant because typically New York is right there. It's usually number 2 or number 3, generally in the top 5 at least.
That's
especially ranked number 4.
Significant, especially with 24 sightings.
They should be pretty high, but I was amazed. They only had 16 sightings, and that translates to a .081. Ouch. Well below average. Then we have Missouri, 18th in population. They had 19 sightings, finishing with a .312. Vermont, ranked number 49th in state population. They only had 2 sightings, but they still managed a .320. But again, only 2 sightings, so it's really, I don't know. It kind of pulls it down a little bit to me. Maine, state of Maine, they're ranked number 42. Their per capita was actually 0.3. I can't remember how many sightings they had. They only had like 2 sightings. New Mexico, this is the most impressive one. I think they win for the month. New Mexico is ranked number 36 in state population. They only had 11 sightings, but their per capita was 0.529. So a half a person per 100,000, or I guess you could say one person in every 200,000 people reported a UFO in New Mexico in October. But again, these just to remind you, these numbers don't represent actual sightings that took place necessarily in that month. Some of these might have happened months ago and they're just being reported. Some of these might have happened years ago and they're finally just getting reported last month. So it doesn't really represent exactly what took place in the month of October, but it gives you kind of a baseline, because I would imagine that a good chunk of these did. And even if something happened, let's say late September and it wasn't reported till October, that still counts for the October sightings. And again, anything that was happening maybe late October, maybe something massive happened on Halloween, wasn't reported until November. That would actually go into November's numbers for MUFON. I kind of wish they would have a way to kind of settle all these numbers and put them into correct areas or correct months, but that's a lot of work. Though I guess a computer could do that. Well, we have what we have, and that's what we have. So now I have to come up with some numbers here. I usually do this, but I forgot. Let's see. We had 659 total for October and 482 for the United States. So I'm going to guess it's got to be a little lower. Let's go. Well, I'm going to go 624 for total worldwide sightings, and we're going to go 439 for U.S. So write that down. See how bad I'm going to be. Sometimes when I do this on the fly, though, we actually do really well. Anyway, that's your MUFON statistics for October 2017. And have a couple of other stories I want to talk about real quick here. It was bound to happen. That's right. Residents in a community just outside St. Petersburg, Florida, awoke on Halloween morning to find something strange in the neighborhood. And it wasn't ghosts. Red balloons had been tied to weights and left near storm drains lining the streets. Probably saw this because it wasn't just in Florida, as many other streets showed photographs of red balloons tied to storm and sewer drains all over the country. Now, back on September 6th, you might remember this, a small town in Pennsylvania asked that people stop putting red balloons out, as it was unnecessarily tying up police and was concerning some residents. Well, it wasn't just there either. It was all over the country. And the Lawrence, Kansas Police Department also tweeted, quote, in all caps, but I'm not going to yell this, "We did the clown thing last year. We aren't doing this again," unquote. Again, in all caps. And back in the first week of September was when the movie It was released in theaters. Well, It looks like the Halloween season brought back this attempt at fear out of the gutter. Ouch. That was bad. The movie is based on the Stephen King novel from 1986, and part two of this movie is slated for release on September 6th, 2019. So it's kind of I don't think I covered this when it first happened. But, you know, as I said, it was bound to happen again. Get it? Okay. Anyway, one other thing I want to cover here. This was kind of a debate at my workplace the other day, and it's confusing because I couldn't understand why people were believing this. But you might have heard, if you weren't aware, NASA has predicted that the Earth will plunge into darkness for 15 days this month, starting, well, tomorrow. So I guess I'm going to be out of power again. That's what NASA's predicting. Well, that's what some online videos and websites will tell you. But is there really a cause for concern? Well, this latest hoax is a piggyback to the earlier claims going back to at least 2011, when it was suggested that the comet Elenin would block out sunlight to Earth, which was actually not possible. In 2012, it was also suggested that planetary alignments were set to cause great blackouts across the world, and that never happened either. The same claim has been made year after year, with the basis for the event changing slightly every year, from severe solar storms to cosmic events or planetary alignments, other solar systems hitting our sun, from cosmic events that happened millions of years ago. All kinds of weird things have been suggested just about every year. And according to the website earthsky.org, NASA has never made such an announcement, and there is no cause for any concern behind any of the claims made. Now, while it's true that Venus and Jupiter will be making a conjunction in the sky, there is nothing that will come from this, as this conjunction is merely from our personal perspective here on this little dot known as Earth, and it's actually been happening for millions, if not billions, of years without any major incident, since any incident would never make any sense occurring in the first place. Now, don't forget, Earth was also claimed to be colliding with a fictional planet of Nibiru back in September, and despite all of the photographs of lens flares, no one has been able to find this elusive giant planet, including millions of astronomers that comb the skies nightly. No, NASA has never made any type of announcement concerning any type of catastrophic event. And a few videos, they actually show footage of scientists making some claims, but these claims are used from other interviews and are put up in such a way to suggest that they support this claim when they're actually discussing something completely different. So don't worry about waking up to total darkness tomorrow morning, unless you get up early like I do and the days are getting shorter. So don't panic. Be wary of these conspiracy theory websites such as Newswatch 33, which is the one that actually started this rumor, and fact check before spreading this misinformation. Now, while it's alluring to think that there are secrets being held from us, to think some YouTube channel full of advertisements and fake stories would be the only source of truth that's just out there in this world. But no. But, you know, I kind of did some research on this. Let me throw the link to that wild accusational story out there in the chat room real quick. And it's kind of weird. I did a little research on this. And the question is it possible for a solar storm to knock out power? And we've all heard about this, and it's absolutely true. And what's scary is on March 13th, 1989, a massive geomagnetic storm knocked out power to the entire Canadian province of Quebec and caused other issues with 200 power grids all over the United States, although none here created any blackouts. The storm was sudden and detected on March 10th. During a massive coronal mass ejection, The cloud of solar plasma hit the Earth's magnetic shield on March 12th, 2 days later, creating northern lights that could be seen as far south as Florida and Cuba. Some satellites in space were sent spinning out of control for hours, as well as the space shuttle Discovery was having some minor unexplainable issues that were noted during the event. But nothing major happened with the space shuttle or the satellites, and the electrical power in Quebec was restored within 12 hours, and nothing major was reported after that initial event. And if you want more information on that little story, I'll throw that in the chat room as well. Well, who knows? I mean, it's, all these predictions about the Earth, the world coming to an end, you know, eventually someone's going to get it right. But we'll never know. We'll never care because the Earth will be over and we won't know. Anyway, quickly, I know I'm out of time here. It's 8 o'clock here on the East Coast, time for my Betty Bye. But anyway, I want to mention, I forgot this. Well, I didn't forget it, but I want to mention this. The book of the week, a very important book, and it's something that I thoroughly enjoy. I know it's a dying thing here. Unfortunately, people don't really care about this kind of thing. But when I was at the convention this 2 weekends ago now, I picked up a book written by Alex Matsuo. It piqued my interest. I'd seen this before. And although I've been doing ghost research for over 20 years, I still like to learn from other people. And a really small book had caught my eye last time, and I kind of thought about it and just never really gotten it. And I figured if I see her again, I remember I'm going to buy this book, and really excited to get my hands on this book because, again, this goes towards something that I enjoy doing, and that's residential cases, doing client-based cases for paranormal investigations, which is a dying thing. People are in love with these prisons and abandoned buildings and all these things, but going to residential locations is where it's at. This is ongoing stuff. This is things happening to people that may have never had these things happen to them before. These are very important cases to do, but they're very difficult. It's not as easy as you think. And Alex does a fantastic job of covering that in her book that's called More Than Ghosts, A Guide to Working Residential Cases in the Paranormal Field. And whoops, let me get the link in there and I get the book cover in there as well. So you guys can see what that looks like. Pretty cool looking. Whoops, that's not the right page. This book is, let's see, it was 2015. Now, when you look at this book, it's only 67 pages, I believe. 67 pages. Doesn't look like much. But I tell you what, it took quite a while to read through this. There's so much information. The typesetting is a little small, but it's packed with really valuable information. And for some people, it might sound like it's common sense, but sometimes you need common sense. And sometimes you don't think of things. You may sound like common sense, but you might not have thought about that when you're putting your own group together. And this is very reminiscent to me of when I first wrote my first three books, essentially, on ghost research, and then my fourth book on the E4 method. And however, this is more updated. This is 2015 that she wrote this, and my stuff was 8 years prior. So this is kind of a more updated, and I think she did a fantastic job of corralling her information. Mine was essentially just on the basics of ghost investigation, where she's really concentrated heavily on residential cases, but at the same time, kind of given some very, very important information on how to operate a paranormal group that a lot of people, I don't think, really look at. And if you look at some of this stuff, you're going to realize that these valuable bits and pieces of information can help your group stick together, because a lot of groups fall apart for some of the stuff that she's talking about in this book. And very happy that she wrote this book. And that even if you don't do client-based cases, this is still very valuable for any team out there that wants to be successful in the future. And I will mention that there is a foreword by Bill Wilkins Jr., and he is the, well, I don't know what his official title is, but he operates ParanormalSocieties.com, which any paranormal group out there is pretty familiar with that website, as it lists all the paranormal groups all over the United States. And used to be something that everybody did. Now it's just basically one site. But anyway, this book does – it's broken down very well, chapter by chapter, discussing things in the past and how she came about into the paranormal field, talking about kind of I guess the perception of the paranormal from the outside. And again, this is written after television shows have really began to alter the culture of the client, which is a very important thing. And it's one of the reasons why I kind of just don't even do residential cases anymore. There's a lot of liability issues and legal potential problems that you're going to bump into. And she does a fantastic job of covering all of those problems or potential problems in this. She also talks about equipment and evidence. And something that I was amazed to see that I don't know if I put that in my book, but background checks, not only for your investigators, but also potentially for clients as well, which I think is unfortunately important in this day and age. Just so much information in this book, and some of the greatest information, however, comes – I didn't expect this. I'd never read this book, and I never really talked to her about this. But I had no idea that she had mentioned my name numerous times in this book. And you know, I've talked about the E4 method here, and you could check that out. If you type in E4 method with my name, you'll find out more information. I have a great amount of respect for people like Brian D. Parsons, who has been able to devise his own methodology and practice for residential cases, and will credit him whenever possible, since my team – the Association for Paranormal Study has had the most productive investigations since adapting aspects of the E4 method into our client work. So if you need a more favorable representation of the E4 method, it's right here in this book. Fantastic book. And she talks about John Sable and a lot of other people, which is good, because you should – you know, use other people to kind of mold and shape your methods. And that's kind of what I did as well. But again, this is a fantastic book. If you're interested even in just having a paranormal team, this is a book that you should get, let alone if you want to do residential cases. This is going to spell it out for you. It's a small book. It's not really that expensive. It's not $9 million, but it's – again, there's so much information in this book. I really, really enjoyed reading this, not just because my name has popped in there a few times and my recommended reading has my books right underneath Lloyd Auerbach, which makes me giddy, but this book is great, and I'm happy that my name is associated with this just because it's such a wonderful book, and I really would give it a ringing endorsement, which I have to do here on Amazon. Great book. Alex Matsuo's More Than Ghosts, A Guide to Working Residential Cases in the Paranormal Field is your book of the week this week. And that is it. I got some overtime coming my way this week. But apologize for being out last week, kind of out of my control, or should I say out of my power. Anyway, okay. Big thanks to Cindy, my producer, for the hard work that she does. And Dita, I don't know what she does, but she's on the payroll, so she does something. Does all my graphics and things and maintains the website. Does a fantastic job. And for Paul in there in the chat room and everyone else who tuned in tonight, thank you very much. I appreciate you listening to the show each and every week. I almost forgot my outro. I have to look for it here. I'll see you next week, but for now, keep your eyes in the skies, your ears in the woods, the hair standing on the back of your neck, and always keep your mind slightly ajar. And above all else, don't stop believing. For the Paranormal News Insider, this is Dr. Brian D. Parsons reporting.